the conflict, so much so that he'd even lie to avoid it. He signed every autograph, shook every hand, kissed every baby. Fluffy was jovial, talented, smart, generous. Uncle Fluffy needed everyone to like him. "I am so good. I am so nice and resourceful. You don't have to worry. I'm harmless. You can trust me. I'll take care of your every need." Uncle Fluffy was born as my strategic childhood persona. If I was funny enough, sweet enough, harmless enough, entertaining enough, then I wouldn't be hurt. My mother would be safe, and my family would be happy. No one would ever leave me. Fluffy wants to be approved of. It's the only safety he can conceive. As an adult, he became my armor and my shield. I was strangling my truth in the hopes of feeling safe, getting approval, and being loved. I want you to have an experience of yourself minus the need to be approved of, Michaela said. Who are you really? What does your heart truly want? What are your deepest values and authentic goals? The problem with Uncle Fluffy is that you're never free to make a pure decision, one that is honest and true for you. You're always forced by Fluffy to compromise and to do the thing that gets the most approval, likes, or sales. Will's creativity is thwarted by Fluffy's need for approval. What are Will's feelings, Will's opinions, Will's needs, Will's ideas? I could see her point that as a child, I had crafted a certain identity, that I had decided that there was a specific way that I had to be to survive and thrive in my environment. I could also see that the behavior was often in conflict with the truth of what I was actually thinking and feeling. But Uncle Fluffy did some beautiful things. He built her lake. He let Willow stop whipping her hair when she was done. He begged Jeff and JL to move to LA. He doubled Cherie's child support when Trey moved in with Will. He auditioned at Quincy Jones's house when Will was too scared and he wanted to leave. Uncle Fluffy was swayed by his admiration for Muhammad Ali to make a movie that Will was too afraid to make. Uncle Fluffy has been a wonderful friend, Michaela said. He just needs to work for you, not the other way around. Uncle Fluffy was created based on a lie, designed on the false premise that something was wrong with me, that I was a coward. His job was to perpetually apologize for my shortcomings and guarantee that I was always safe and loved. And even as the awareness dawned that perhaps he had outlived his usefulness, the fact still remained. Uncle Fluffy paid the bills. Fluffy was further complicated by his shadow counterpart, whom Michaela named the General. When Fluffs had exhausted his reserves of charm and magnanimity, and yet was still unsuccessful in his attempts to secure adoration, he summoned the General. The General's job was to get the flag to the top of the hill by any means necessary, and to covertly and not so covertly punish those who dared to dissent, even myself. Basically, when I had suppressed my real needs so thoroughly for so long and still didn't get the adoration and approval I'd sought, my anguish would express itself as the General. But Uncle Fluffy is masking my true feelings, which I'm not even in touch with. When the General shows up, people are shocked and confused. It was sweetness, 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 and then sour, sour, sourness. These personas weave a universe in which you are trapped, Michaela said. A spiderweb of demands, obligations, and expectations. And if you dare to step outside these constructs, you receive exactly the disdain and disapproval you fear most. But neither of these identities is you. The question is, can you find safety in yourself and not from some external source of approval? Can you become a freestanding man? Michaela and I worked together over the next few years. Her curriculum was centered on the idea of becoming a freestanding man. Essentially, a freestanding man is self-aware, self-reliant, self-motivated, self-confident, and utterly unswayed by people's approval or disapproval. He knows who he is, he knows what he wants, and because of this, he surrenders his considerable gifts into the service of others. You have to sensitize yourself to your own inner landscape and map out the terrain of who you really are, your true desires and true needs, Michaela said. When someone asks how you feel, don't just throw out a fluffy answer. Think about it. Narrate your feelings, at least internally. Michaela was trying to get me to put honesty and authenticity above my need for approval as a means of cultivating trust in myself and becoming trustworthy to others. In the beginning, I found myself still collapsing in the face of disapproval. It was hard to see disappointment in people's eyes or feel their anger towards me if I refused to fulfill their desires. I was trying to learn to be true to myself and not betray myself and override my own feelings. It was excruciating trying to stop saying yes when I meant no, and to stop saying no to things that I actually wanted. One of the first things we set out to dismantle was my FAME belief system, that if I was in public, I wasn't allowed to say no to any fan requests. If someone wanted a picture, an autograph, a handshake, a hug, it didn't matter if I was eating or talking or not feeling well. I had obligated myself to fulfilling the promise of my image. In 2017, I was on the jury at the Cannes Film Festival alongside Pedro Almodovar, Maren Ade, Fan Bingbing, Park Chan-wook, Jessica Chastain, Anya Jawi, Paolo Sorrentino, and Gabrielle Yared. During this time, I was practicing the behavioral change of setting and honoring my personal boundaries. I was going to tell people the truth of how I was feeling. I was going to say no when I meant no, and yes when I meant yes. It was day 5, and we'd already watched 14 movies, 8 of which were subtitled, and 6 of which were experimental. The jury deliberations were the greatest cinematic education of my life, but watching and debating 3 movies a day was physically and intellectually exhausting. With 1 more movie to watch before dinner, I needed a beat to be quiet and reset. I had 30 minutes to hit the gym before rejoining the jury. I had told myself that this was my time, for me, and I had promised myself that I would not allow anyone to infringe on it. I entered the gym, and it was totally empty. Thank the blessed heavens. I headed over to the ab crunch machine. I was going to do 15 minutes of core, 15 minutes of cardio, and be out. Perfect. Midway through my second set, a 30-something black dude with a British accent entered and immediately noticed me. He whipped out his phone as he approached, scrambling to start recording. "Hey, Will," he said, flipping into landscape mode. "Say hi to my cousin." As he got within a couple feet of my face, I reached up, putting my hand over the lens of his camera and pushed it down. "Hey, sorry, man," I said. "I'm training right now." "Oh, it's just a quick video, Will," he said. "My cousin has Down syndrome. He loves you. I promise it'll be quick. The Fresh Prince is the only thing that makes him smile." "Uncle Fluffy, Will, just do the video. It's not even for him. It's for a kid with Down syndrome." "Me. But I promised myself that this is my private time, and he can't just start filming me without asking first." "Uncle Fluffy, he was excited. He's clearly a big fan. Fresh Prince is the only thing that makes the kid smile. Don't be a dick." me. I'm not being a dick. I'm trying to honor my promises to myself. I'm allowed to not do a video if I don't want to. Is there no sacred space for myself? Uncle Fluffy, sure there is. Your mansion, your limousine services, your penthouse suite, your private jets, all the shit we wouldn't have if I let your newfangled sense of self run our lives. Will, there's nobody in here, the guy said. It's just us. Please, just say hi. I know I looked crazy as shit to this dude. I'm still holding his camera down with a 1,000-yard stare in my eyes as the war within me raged. Look, I'm sorry, man, I said. But no. The pain in this man's eyes is burned in my memory. It brings tears even to this day. He looked at me with such disbelief. This is not Will Smith. But why not, Will? He said. I paused. I searched for the deepest, most honest answer. Because I don't want to, I said. The man shook his head in disgust, turned, and left the gym. I knew I had done right by myself, but I hated that someone else, an innocent, had gotten caught in the crossfire of my internal war. I never made it to cardio. I went back to my room and could not stop crying. Over the next 2 years, Michaela and I were joined at the hip. She repeated over and over again, explore, experience, experiment, expand. She set free the wild-minded pathfinder within me, whose vision had been narrowed by the obligations and expectations of being Will Smith. Michaela encouraged me to try new things and meet new people, rekindle my spirit of exploration and adventure. I began to take a fresh sampling of the fruits of the human experience. As you break out of the narrow boundaries of Will Smith, Michaela said, let's really examine all the beliefs and constructs and paradigms that you've bound yourself to. There's a thing I've heard you say a few times. 99% is the same as zero.
Oh, yeah. I said, Daddy-O used to say that all the time.
Well, you know, mathematically speaking, 99% is about as far from zero as you can get. I had used that phrase thousands of times in my life. But for some reason, when Michaela said it, I truly heard it for the first time. This had been a stable foundational axiom that had driven my operating system. But its falsity was so obvious, it opened me up to reevaluating and reexamining all of my assumptions. If 99% is not the same as zero, what is 72% or 23% or 84.69%? Hell, what zero? Rather than seeing every situation as binary, all of a sudden the possibilities became infinite. I realized that I had seen the world, but never on vacation. So I began to travel with no agenda. I spent time with people I admired who I just wanted to get to know, with no financial or business outcome attached. I visited with famed British Iraqi architect, the Queen of the Curve, Zaha Hadid. I became friends with jazz rock pianist Eric Robert Lewis. He told me he'd been trained as a classical pianist and the rigid confines of that discipline had sent him into a nervous breakdown. While in a mental hospital, Bruce Lee had spiritually visited him and told him to use the piano to fight his demons. Ilu, as he's known, developed a martial arts style of playing the piano. He got rid of the stool, he armored himself with steel forearm sleeves, assumed the kata stance, and began to play in his own liberated one-of-a-kind style. But Michaela's most important initiative came when she found out that I couldn't swim. Not on my watch, she said, in one of the only times I managed to surprise her. When I told her I wanted a harem, she didn't flinch,
but me not being able to swim sent her feverishly texting my publicist, Meredith O'Sullivan Wasson, who's friends with the four-time Olympic gold medalist in swimming, Janet Evans.
You are going to develop a relationship with the ocean, the big she, Michaela said. The ocean is the ultimate woman, a magnificent feminine environment. If you can understand her, you'll understand us all. The ocean holds all the chaotic glory of Mother Nature, and no amount of power or intellect will ever be able to control or manipulate her. She doesn't care how you're feeling or how you want her to be. All of the things that happen in a woman's psyche and body are analogous to the ocean. The beauty, the storms, the nourishment, the danger, the moods and weather patterns, birth and death. The big she will not be conquered or subdued. Your only hope to truly enjoy her is to love her, respect her, and surrender. I really like this for you because you will be forced to have a beginner's mind. You'll have to navigate her moods and emotions, and you'll have to know when to bow out. I began to woo the big she. Our first date was 1 hour off of Lizard Island on the Great Barrier Reef. I learned to swim, and I took up scuba diving. When we got a little more serious, I went to the Maldives and found myself in something out of Finding Nemo. When I wanted to explore her feisty side, I dove with 14-foot, 700-pound tiger sharks on Tiger Beach in the Bahamas. And when I felt I was ready to taste her depths, I took an Ocean X Triton submersible beyond the midnight zone, below the bioluminescent band, 3,000 feet down to what looked like another planet. There were deep sea creatures hidden in her fathoms that defied my definition of life, that seemed to have been created by another god. I began to see the personality of the big she as an instructive embodiment of the flow of life. I realized that if I am to enjoy her beauty and her bounty and avoid being destroyed by her, she demands that I am fully attuned, attentive, and committed to understanding her. I settled into the acceptance of my powerlessness, which strangely liberated me. Surrender had always been a negative word for me. It meant losing or failing or giving up. But my burgeoning relationship with the ocean was exposing that my sense of control was actually an illusion. Surrender transformed from a weakness word to an infinite power concept. I had had a bias towards action, thrusting, pushing, striving, struggling, doing. And I began to realize that their opposites were equally as powerful. Inaction, receptiveness, acceptance, non-resistance, being. Stopping was equally as powerful as going. Resting was equally as powerful as training. Silence was equally as powerful as talking. Letting go was equally as powerful as grasping. Surrender to me no longer meant defeat. It was now an equally powerful tool of manifestation. Losing could be equal to winning in terms of my growth and development. I began to understand a perplexing phrase that Gigi used to use, let go and let God. That had always seemed wrong to me. It felt like absolving yourself of your responsibilities, like something that people say when they're too lazy to do what's necessary to build the life they want. But all of a sudden, it took on new and magical meaning. There's an energy that's at work while you're asleep. The energy that fires the sun, that moves the ocean, that beats your heart. You don't have to do everything. In fact, most of the things that get done, you didn't have anything to do with them. And actually, it's a great thing that you were asleep, because if you'd been awake, you probably would have messed it up. And then
a new wording of Gigi's axiom came into my mind. It's not just let go and let God. It's let go and let God work. The surfer and the ocean are a team. The mountain and the climber are partners, not adversaries. The great river is going to do 99% of the work. Your 1% is to study it, to understand it, to respect its power, and creatively dance within its currents and its laws. Act when the universe is open, and rest when she's closed. I had never heard of it before. I've never smoked weed, never done cocaine or taken any pills, and other than a vodka and cranberry once in a while, I will pass a piss test at the Tour de France. So when my friend Veronica suggested it, I laughed politely and said, thank you, but no thank you, I don't mess with drugs. Neither do I, she said. Ayahuasca is not drugs. It's medicine. I've known Veronica for years. We've never had sex, but we argued like we did. We disagreed about everything. I was incensed by her pessimism, and she in turn scorned my optimism. It never dawned on either of us to just talk to other people. I guess we kind of used each other to crash test our theories about life. We knew the other would never easily agree, so when an idea got passed, we knew it was a keeper. But something was new. Her eyes were different. Her energy was non-resistant, flexible. She'd had a rough childhood, which I'm sure contributed to her combative disposition. But now, she was calm, stable. There was an undeniable joy about her. She was filled with fresh insight and the passion of someone who'd been somewhere extraordinary and had been utterly transformed. I found myself hanging on her every word. She embodied a new wisdom. Her heart had always felt closed and impenetrable, but now she was open, warm, reachable. In the past, I'd always felt like her parent trying to wrestle a hard-headed child into reality. Today, I felt like Matt Damon listening to Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. I was riveted. I was intrigued. I was curious. Well, whatever you did, I want to do that, I said. Veronica laughed the laugh of the initiated to the uninitiated. She paused and then began to try to explain the inexplicable. Ayahuasca changed my life, she said. So how's it work? Well, it's a ceremony that goes from sunset to sunrise. It traditionally takes place in the jungles of South America, mostly Peru now. But wherever you do it, it's led by a shaman. It begins with drinking the most disgusting tea you can possibly imagine. After about an hour, it kicks in. And then she shakes her head and shivers, like she's seen things she'll never be able to unsee. And then, what? I said. Well, it traps you with your mind. Well, that don't sound fun at all, I said. Any issues you may be struggling with, the medicine goes right to them, she says, and brings them to the surface, making you look at them, experience them, and ultimately heal them. I never told you this before, but when I was a teenager, I had an abortion. It was the most devastating choice I ever made. I've been haunted and crippled. I've done therapy for decades, but have never been able to shake the shame. In my ayahuasca ceremony, I met my child. He was in heaven. He was so happy, so sweet, so beautiful, I wailed and purged for hours. He forgave me. He even asked me to name him. I named him Zion. And in one night, I got free from a lifetime of guilt. I could sense her yearning to share the fruits of her journey, but there was a hesitation. "It's fucking brutal," she said. "It ultimately ends in revelation and healing, but the bus trip winds through the darkest parts of your mind. It's rough, but it'll help you find what you're looking for." Ayahuasca is a sacred brew. It has been used for millennia by the indigenous tribes of the Amazonian jungle during spiritual ceremonies and shamanic rituals. It's a kind of tea made from the bark and stems of a tropical South American vine, sometimes mixed with other psychotropic plants. The name comes from the Quechua language, where aya means soul and huasca is vine. Translation, vine of the soul. Ayahuasca contains a mind-altering compound called dimethyltryptamine, DMT, and is considered a sacred medicine employed by serious spiritual seekers, not for recreational use. Ayahuasca's healing properties are currently being used in the treatment of PTSD, drug addiction, depression, and anxiety, among many other physical and psychological ailments. I do not condone, nor do I suggest, the use of ayahuasca or any other substance without professional medical prescription and supervision. I struggled with the decision of whether to even share my journey with ayahuasca in this book. The only reason I'm writing about it here is because it's the truth of my experience. The room was dark. A small cabin, one room and a bathroom. Ancient Peruvian tribal chants and sacred melodies drone ethereally from a small speaker in the corner. Images of deities cover the walls. Handmade instruments are strewn around a wooden altar. Blankets, cushions, mats, pillows cover the floor. The shaman lives here. Her name is Beata, mid-40s. She reminds me of Meryl Streep, if Meryl had moved to Peru on her 21st birthday to study botany and spiritual healing. She hands me a bucket and a small clay cup. The smell of the ayahuasca preempts my inquiry about the bucket. Beata takes her seat in front of the altar. We've had very little conversation, and I'm beginning to feel concerned that she may not be aware that I've never done anything like this before. I'd followed the basic instructions: no medications, drugs, or alcohol for 2 weeks prior, no food after 2 p.m. day of, no drinks after 5 p.m. Arrive at 7:30 in loose-fitting clothes, and ceremony at 8. But it seemed like she needed to be talking more. This feels too big for her to just be setting shit up casually. Like, "Hey, lady, I'm a little shook over here. I don't really know much about ayahuasca," I said. I did some personal research, but is there an orientation of the process or procedure?" Beata smiled the smile of the initiated to the uninitiated. "No," she said sweetly. To put it mildly, that answer left me somewhat unsatisfied. I just want to be clear about how, you know, and what I'm supposed to expect," I stumbled. "The vine will lead you," Beata said reassuringly. "Just surrender. Let yourself be guided. I'm only here to help you navigate the journey." "Right, I get that," I said, totally not getting it. So what's my next thing?" She pointed to the burnt orange clay cup.
When you're ready. I drank the brew. 10 minutes. Nothing. 25 minutes. Nada. 40 minutes. Zippo. Maybe it doesn't work on me. At an hour, the novelty of waiting had worn off. I figured I was immune. It was 9 p.m., and I realized I had agreed to do this stupid shit till sunrise. My little mat on the floor was comfortable, so I said fuck it and went to sleep. When I woke up, I was floating deep in outer space. As I regained my bearings, I realized that I was trillions of light years away from Earth. I was so far away that I knew I would never see anything or anyone I loved ever again. This is where I would be for eternity. As I digest the magnitude of my predicament, I begin to glide through the infinity of stars. I notice that they're not stars as we know them. It's as if Picasso had painted outer space, colors and cubes and angles. I'm suddenly overwhelmed by the majesty of my surroundings. This is the most beautiful place I've ever been in my life. As I'm distracted in awe, I can sense a presence behind me. It's a woman. I turn to see her, but she's unseeable. I can feel the warmth of her energy close behind me, as close as she could be without touching. She's happy I'm here, and I can tell she will never leave me. Somehow, I know she's been waiting for me. Her voice centers directly behind my right ear, as if her lips were only millimeters away. I turn again, craving just a glimpse of this beatific goddess, but as I move, she moves. I can tell I'm not meant to see her, but I'm okay with that, because every second with her quenches my lifelong thirst. She is everything. Lover, teacher, mother, protector, guide. She is all I have ever dreamed of and everything I have ever wanted. I can tell she knows everything I need to know and how to get everywhere I want to go. She is my goal, my solution, my answer. She is the top of the mountain and the sky beyond. Where are we? I say softly. What do you mean, silly? She says in a tone that melts away everything but bliss. This place is beautiful, I say. This is not a place, silly. She kept endearingly calling me silly. I've never seen anywhere more beautiful than this, I said. She laughs. Why does that make you laugh? I ask. This is you, silly, she said. Huh? What do you mean? This is not a place. This is you. My heart begins to race as I look around, bearing witness to the grandeur of this infinite paradise. Wait a minute, I say. All of this is me? Yes, silly. I'm this beautiful. Of course you are, she says. Her words unlock the emotional floodgates within me. I begin to sob and purge a lifetime of insecurities, self-doubts, and inadequacies violently flushing out of me. Simultaneously, the revelation of my inner beauty fills my heart and mind with possibilities. If I'm this beautiful, I don't need number one movies to feel good about myself. If I'm this beautiful, I don't need hit records to feel worthy of love. If I'm this beautiful, I don't need Jada or anybody else to validate me. If I'm this beautiful and I have this internal sanctuary I can always return to, that I don't need anybody to approve of me. I approve of me. I am enough. This was my first tiny taste of freedom. An invisible yoke had been lifted from my neck. All of my needing and grasping and clinging and lusting and demanding and maneuvering and reaching and craving, all of the insatiable desires that had kept me on my hamster wheel of misery were falling away. I no longer needed to chase the proverbial carrot on the stick. I wasn't starving anymore. In my 50 plus years on this planet, this is the unparalleled greatest feeling I've ever had. In the following 2 years, I did 14 ceremonies. In 8 of them, the woman I would come to know as Mother showed up, each time with detailed advice and instructions. 3 of the times that she did not appear were among the most hellish psychological experiences I've ever endured. In my second ceremony, Mother repeated for what felt like 5 hours straight, "Stop talking." She said it so many times that I wanted to bang my head on the floor. She was referring to the constant inner chatter that runs incessantly in my head, planning, strategizing, debating, assessing, critiquing, self-judging, questioning, doubting. She pummeled me with the phrase thousands of times, "Stop talking." And at some point, just before sunrise, I noticed it. Silence. My inner roommates had stopped talking. It was euphoric. Mother let me bathe in the peace of my inner quietude for about 40 minutes. Then, without words, she conveyed why I needed to stop talking. In essence, she told me I should be still and I should be quiet, in order to better observe and understand the people and circumstances around me. She had watched me batter myself for so many years trying to impose my will on the world. Her point was, if I stopped talking and thinking so much, I could see and sense the universal tides, and I could align my energies to them and achieve twice as much with half as much effort. I heard an echo of Gigi's words to me so many years before. "You know, if you stop talking so much, maybe you could see some of them hits coming." Minimizing my talking became my practice for maximizing my awareness. I had always seen the world as my battlefield. I now understood that the true combat zone was my mind.
Chapter 21, Love. Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Idiopathic heart failure. Coronary artery disease. Atrial fibrillation. A normal heart ejection fraction is 55 to 60%. Daddy-O's is down to 10%. His long history of smoking, inhaling refrigerant, and exposure to toxic chemicals, combined with a lifetime of excessive alcohol use. "So how long?" I said. "You should come home." Dr. Ayla Stanford had been our family physician for a few years now. She'd been wrestling with Daddy-O to make aggressive life changes to preserve and extend the quality of his golden years. Daddy-O had survived 2 heart attacks during my childhood. He would tell the stories as a badge of honor. For his second heart attack, he said he felt it coming on. His left arm gave out, so he drove himself to the hospital using only his right arm. When Dr. Ayla would plead with him to change his habits, he would say, "Shit, if I stop smoking and drinking, I'll probably walk outside and get hit by a bus." "So how long, Ayla?" I asked. 6 weeks. I had just finished shooting Collateral Beauty. It's a film about a father who has to cope with the death of his daughter. As a part of my character research, I had spent the last 5 months doing a deep dive on the spiritual, psychological, cultural rituals and healing practices that help people face the profound suffering of losing a loved one. I met with priests, imams, shamans, rabbis, gurus. I read a ton of books on death. On Death and Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying by Tibetan Buddhist teacher Sogyal Rinpoche. Tuesdays with Mori by Mitch Albom. The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. Going into the role, I felt totally prepared and confident that I could accurately depict the triumphant arc from tragic loss toward perfect healing. I'd been trying to find the solution to the agony of loss for my character, but now I was being forced to find it for myself. Daddy-O knew he was dying. His body was frail. His muscle had deteriorated. His skin draped over his bones like a shroud. His bluish-gray recliner set to its halfway position. Don Lemon muted in the background, Tarotin 100 in hand. Less than a carton of cigarettes left in his life. Daddy-O had told Dr. Ayla that he would either quit smoking or drinking, and she could pick. Based on his medication profile, she picked drinking.
"Hey, man," he said, perking up as I walked in. "What up, Daddy-O?"
I approached him to perform what had become our ritual greeting. He leaned forward, I palmed his bald head, and I kissed him where his bald spot used to be. 5 years earlier, Daddy-O's bald spot had become so prominent that I begged him to shave his head. "Come on, Dad, you rocking a homie the clown. That's not a good look, man." He fought me for over a year until one day I cornered him on the set of Men in Black 3, wrestled him into the barber's chair, and cut his entire head bald. He loved it and wore his head that way for the rest of his life. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying lays out the most critical tenets to supporting and soothing the transition of a dying loved one. The first idea that jumped off the page for me was that a dying person often needs permission to die. The book posits that sometimes a dying person will fight and struggle to stay alive if they don't have the sense that you're going to be okay without them. This can create horrific and painful final days. In order for our loved one to let go and die peacefully, they need to be explicitly reassured that we're going to be okay after they're gone, that they did a great job with their life, and that we can handle it from here. Similarly, Rinpoche states, a dying person most needs to be shown as unconditional a love as possible, released from all expectations. These concepts crystallized the mission in my mind. I was going to put aside all of my agendas, traumas, questions, and direct my full energies toward the most compassionate and merciful transition that I could tender. Around week 3, I arrived. Standard head kiss. I took my seat on the floor. Chris Cuomo was muted today. Daddy-O's ability to eat was deteriorating. He had macaroni and cheese, braised beef, and broccoli, untouched in front of him. If Daddy-O isn't eating his mac and cheese, he must really not be feeling well. "Hey, Dad.
I said nervously. You did good. What you mean, he asked. With your life. I don't think he was expecting to hear that. He took a pull of his Tarrant 100, turned his eyes back to the TV. He didn't seem like he was ready to go there just yet, but I was. I'm saying you did great with your life. And when you're ready to go, I want you to know that it's okay. You raised me well, and I got it from here. I'm going to take care of everybody you love. Daddy-O nodded his head, maintaining his stoic demeanor. His eyes welled, yet never broke from CNN. But I knew he'd heard me. The soldier was gone. The ogre barely had enough strength to lift his spoon. He even needed my help to go to the bathroom. As a final attempt to maintain a semblance of his military dignity, he gave me detailed instructions on locking the wheels of his wheelchair, setting it into perfect position adjacent to his recliner, being careful to close off the left footrest, leaving the right open for him to put his foot on, and the critical importance of placing my left knee outside of his right knee and my right knee straddled between his legs in order to safely lift and maneuver him. My right cheek positioned to his, stepping back at 45 degrees to turn him and deposit him into the wheelchair. One night, as I delicately wheeled him from his bedroom toward the bathroom, a darkness arose within me. The path between the two rooms goes past the top of the stairs. As a child, I'd always told myself that I would one day avenge my mother, that when I was big enough, when I was strong enough, when I was no longer a coward, I would slay him. I paused at the top of the stairs. I could shove him down and easily get away with it. I'm Will Smith. Nobody would ever believe I killed my father on purpose. I'm one of the best actors in the world. My 911 call would be Academy Award level. As the decades of pain, anger, and resentment coursed, then receded, I shook my head and proceeded to wheel Daddy-O to the bathroom. Thank God we're judged by our actions and not by our trauma-driven inner outbursts. I came to see him every week for the next month and a half. There's something strangely clarifying and cleansing about looking into the eyes of someone who's accepted their pending death. The awareness of death bestows profundity and clears all the bullshit out the way. The finality of it makes every moment feel infinitely significant. Every hello felt like a gift from God. We were both overwhelmed with gratitude that we got to see each other one more time. And then every goodbye was complete and perfect because we were saying goodbye with the full knowledge that this might be our last. Every laugh, every story takes on weight and meaning in that simple fact. Death has a way of transforming the mundane into the magical. Hellos and goodbyes should be that way in our everyday lives because the reality is tomorrow is not promised. I began to embrace every hello with gratitude and to never take a goodbye for granted. The level of devoted focus, honesty, and compassion that Daddy-O and I shared became the aspirational model for love in my life. Daddy-O had been given 6 weeks, and he ended up living for 3 months. I remember on week 9, I made my trip to see him. Our meetings had been joyful and poignant, but today he's in an uncharacteristically despondent mood. shirt off, Tartan 100 in hand, hunched over his brown wooden folding tray, food untouched. Standard bald head kiss.
Daddy-o, what's going on?
He puts his cigarette down, pensively gazed out at the Ben Franklin Bridge arcing over the Schuylkill River.
Man, Daddy-o said, you tell motherfuckers you're gonna be dead in 6 weeks, and 9 weeks later you still hanging around. Shit's embarrassing.
This was probably the second biggest laugh Daddy-o and I ever shared.
Cut!
About 10 days later, I was on the set of Bright, a Netflix fantasy action cop film directed by David Ayer. We were shooting in downtown Los Angeles. Joel Edgerton, my co-star, was behind the wheel of our patrol car. He was my partner in the movie. David Ayer approaches the window.
Bro, you need to call your father immediately, he says softly. It's an emergency.
Even when you're expecting these phone calls, it doesn't make it less jarring. My heart was racing. I dialed Daddy-O's cell. He answered.
Hey, man. Hey, Daddy-O, what's up?
I think it's tonight, he said. His words hit me like 1,000 volts.
Okay,
I said calmly. The Tibetan Book of Living and Dying had stressed the importance of making a calm space for the transition of loved ones.
Do you want to FaceTime? I asked. Yeah, but shit, I don't know how to do that.
I got you. I'll FaceTime you, I said. You just have to answer.
Ellen, come do this FaceTime thing. Well, about the car, he yelled to my sister, who had just arrived.
My cousin Ricky, a Philadelphia fireman who had been caring for Daddy-O, is holding the phone. It's 2 a.m. in an empty downtown L.A. parking lot. I stand under the brightest streetlight I can find. I want him to be able to see me. We simply look at each other. 20 minutes of silence. Finally, I hear my sister Ellen in the background whisper to Daddy-O.
Dad, you're just looking. You don't have anything you want to say to Will?
Daddy-O searches for one last piece of wisdom, one final brick. But he's empty. He slowly shakes his head, a final surrender.
Shit. Anything I ain't told this motherfucker already, he sure ain't gonna get it from me tonight.
We shared a final laugh. We said goodbye. And 45 minutes later, Daddy-O was gone. One of the central and most critical tenets of filmmaking is know your ending. When you understand the emotional, philosophical, and moral conclusion of your film, you can better craft everything that leads up to it. The comprehension of the physical plot and thematic endpoints allows you to reverse engineer a more resonant and enjoyable journey for the audience. The end of a film is similar to the punchline of a joke. You want the meaning to erupt in the hearts and minds of the audience. Imagine beginning to tell a joke without knowing the punchline. Life is like that. You're born into a bunch of characters. Everybody's looking at you. You can't communicate, you can't walk, you can't feed yourself. Yet everybody seems to be excited to see what you're going to end up doing. So you begin telling your joke with no fucking clue what the punchline is going to be. You're watching the audience. Sometimes they chuckle, sometimes they boo, but deep down inside, they hope you land the punchline.
In his final days, Daddy-O wasn't worried about ACRAC. He wasn't worried about money. He didn't even care about food anymore. He had a single burning question about his ending. Was my life useful? Daddy-O needed to know that our lives were better because he was here. He wanted to be reassured that in spite of all his shortcomings and fumbles and mistakes, that in the net analysis, his assets outweighed his liabilities, and his life had been valuable. When Gigi died, it was a completely different experience. She had been so certain in her loving service and contribution to her family and her community and her commitment to God's children that she was excited to go to heaven. To Gigi, God and love were synonymous. They were inseparable and indistinguishable. She worshiped God by loving others. Love was the only commandment that mattered. To her, if you were being loving, you wouldn't need all the others. There was no negative energy around her passing whatsoever. Gigi was so completely fulfilled that I never even cried. She was ready to go and felt that her work here was finished. I got my first true glimpse into the secret of the smile. I had held a misconception around the physics of ultimate happiness. I had thought that I could gain and win and achieve and conquer and acquire and succeed my way to love and happiness. 8 consecutive number one hit movies, 30 million records, 4 Grammys, and hundreds of millions of dollars makes you happy, right? Makes people love you, right? The fundamental flaw of this theory is the belief that the smile comes from outside, that it is acquired or achieved from external sources or conditions, that someone will love you so much, they will adore you so deeply and thoroughly that they will fill you with the bliss of the smile. Spoiler alert, there are no relationships, careers, or houses with a name that can fill the hole. There is nothing that you can receive from the material world that will create inner peace or fulfillment. The truth is, the smile is generated through output. It's not something you get. It's something you cultivate through giving. In the end, it will not matter one single bit how well they loved you. You will only gain the smile based on how well you loved them. The physics of love and happiness are counterintuitive. As long as we're stuck in the need to receive, in the cycle of grasping and clinging and demanding that people in the world around us meet our needs, we will be locked into disappointment, anger, and misery. The sweet paradox is being fulfilled by giving, that your output precipitates the input. Giving and receiving become simultaneous. To love and to be loved is the highest human reward and ecstasy. Allowing the best within you to serve and unleash the best within others is the most intense of human pleasures. When I say love, I mean discovering, cultivating, and sharing your unique gifts for the purpose of uplifting and empowering your loved ones. The smile is a combination of the recognition of the unique treasure within you and the realization that the treasure is multiplied through giving it away. Everybody is struggling. Everybody is having a hard time. Life can be brutal, chaotic, confusing, and excruciating. Our hearts are starving. Loving, giving, helping, serving, protecting, nourishing, empowering, and forgiving are the secrets of the smile. Can you imagine what it would feel like if somebody loved you, gave you all you needed, helped you, served you, protected you, nourished you, empowered you, and forgave you? For many of us, the answer to that question is no. But what Gigi knew, and what Nelson Mandela knew, what Muhammad Ali knew, and what Daddy-O knew in his final moments, is that you must give it to receive it. Daddy-O had poured all of his gifts into me, and at the end of his life, he saw that I had used them to build my life. He was fulfilled through his giving. And warts and all, he was content in how he had loved me. And then by the grace of a benevolent creator, in his final days, when he had nothing left, I was blessed to pour my gifts into him. Births, weddings, and funerals have a way of sifting the gold out of the dirt and the rocks. Daddy-O's death served as a wake-up call for me. As Jada and I sat at his funeral, I became chillingly aware of the fact that one day, one of us would be saying goodbye to the other. And I questioned, what did I want our ending to be? Our time apart had helped us both to discover the power of loving in freedom. We are simultaneously 100% bound together and 100% free. We agreed that we were both imperfect people doing our best to figure out how to be in this world joyfully. What we needed from each other was unconditional love and support, not judgment, not punishment, but total, unbending devotion to each other's growth and well-being. We came to see our marriage as a spiritual discipline, what Bhakti Tirtha Swami calls the ultimate school of love. This relationship is our classroom. We are learning to cultivate care, concern, and compassion in the most intimate and difficult of circumstances. There are few things in life more challenging than being married. The intimacy tends to stir up and expose our most poisonous inner energies. If we can learn to love here, we can love anywhere. The question is, can we love each other unconditionally? Or is our love contingent upon the other person acting exactly as we need them to? It's easy to love somebody when they do what you want them to do, exactly how you want them to do it. But how do you behave when they step outside of your picture? How do you treat them when they hurt you? Those are the times that determine whether or not you actually love somebody. Love is hard. It takes enormous courage to open a wounded heart over and over again to the possibility of love's bliss. Like Charlie Mack always says, "Scared money can't make no money." Love demands bravery, a willingness to risk it all. But bravery doesn't mean the absence of fear. Bravery is learning to continue forward even when you're terrified. Jada and I agreed that we would ride together for this lifetime, no matter what. The jump. We're about to witness something that has never been done before. You've read about it, you've tweeted about it, and it's finally here. I'm Alfonso Ribeiro, and this is Will Smith, The Jump, coming to you from the Grand Canyon. Today, on his 50th birthday, he will face his fears and heli bungee jump over this jaw-dropping gorge. Now, to be clear, he is bungee jumping out of a helicopter 1,800 feet above the ground. I just got chills thinking about this. This is crazy.
Yo, Alfonso, stop saying that shit like that, Charlie Mack barked.
Charlie, I'm on the air right now, live, Alfonso hissed.
I don't give a fuck, Alf. Stop making it sound like it's going to go bad. like it's too dangerous.
But also, the weather here can be tricky at the Grand Canyon. We had lightning storms all day yesterday, but we have an experienced stunt team and aerial crew who is keeping track of the winds and the temperature. Okay, we're out, Alfonso, the producer yells.
Seriously, Alf, I don't like your whole energy.
Charlie, I'm doing my job. Will asked me to host, Alfonso said, chopping his right hand into his left. He wants me to build the suspense.
Don't build no suspense that make it seem like he gonna die.
That's where the suspense comes from, Charlie. So why are you heli bungee jumping over the Grand Canyon? When I first heard that question out loud, I thought, well, it's obvious. I'm in the wicked clutches of an anaconda of a midlife crisis. But I was live on YouTube, so I couldn't say that. Here's what I actually said. I've had an interesting relationship with fear my whole life. I've traversed the spectrum of fear reactions from complete debilitation through inspiration and sometimes slipping into outright foolishness. But when the idea of heli bungee jumping over to Grand Canyon came up, I wasn't debilitated and I sure wasn't inspired. All I could think was, that shit is stupid. My childhood Grand Canyon trip was a deeply meaningful experience. I've always remembered how beautiful it was. But I also remember how terrified I was to walk up to the edge. Harry even got close enough to drop his drum in it. But I stayed back, too scared to take in the full majesty. I've realized that, for some reason, God placed the most beautiful things in life on the other side of our worst terrors. If we are not willing to stand in the face of the things that most deeply unnerve us and then step across the invisible line into the land of dread, then we won't get to experience the best that life has to offer. So I've been making a conscious effort to attack all the things that I'm scared of. And this is scary. When Yes Theory challenged me to heli bungee, my heart jumped. And I've learned to recognize that feeling as a signal that the great gift has presented itself. As soon as my heart jumps, I'm in. I gotta do it now. But I also can't be outdone. So when Yes Theory said heli bungee, I added over to Grand Canyon and on my 50th birthday. Everybody is here. My mom, Jada, Cherie, Trey, Jaden, Willow, Harry, Ellen, Pam, Ashley, Kyle, Dion, Gammy, Caleb, JL, Charlie Mack, Omar, Scotty, and Ty, and on and on and on. As I took in the dueling landscapes of friends, family, and Grand Canyon, and saw the faces of the next generation, Harry's kids, Ellen's kids, Pam's, JL's, Charlie's, Omar's, Caleb's, Scotty, and Ty's, I realized I'm standing in the middle of my dream. This is what I have always wanted. Everybody I love is here, together, as a family. And I had brought them to the Grand Canyon to witness the senseless and horrific death of their Uncle Will. I could hear the news reports. Will Smith, in what is presumed to have been a drug-induced psychosis, leapt to his death in a bizarre heli-bungee accident over the Grand Canyon early yesterday afternoon. He is survived by his wife, his baby mama, three children, a smorgasbord of nephews and nieces, extended family and friends, and a day hiker wondering what all the sirens were about. He was just 50. In a statement released by YouTube executives, Smith was described as a true American lunatic. End quote. But another thing happened. The kids got it. They seemed to understand the necessity to confront and overcome the things that most terrify them. My niece Kayla held onto my leg as I approached the helicopter. And beyond the point where she could no longer follow, she screamed, "I'm going to be brave like you when I grow up, Uncle Will." "Willow, how do you feel about your dad going to do this?" Alfonso asked. "I just want him to do what makes him happy. And obviously I'm nervous, but this is what he wants, and we're all here to support him. And I just want him to do what he loves," Willow said. "I'm just really happy he's doing what he wants to do," Trey chimed in.
I mean, bungee jumping out of a helicopter over the Grand Canyon, I couldn't say I've ever heard of that done in history, so I'm looking forward. He always taught us to just conquer fear. Are you trying to terrify your children? Jada asked.
No. My kids don't get scared. Jaden, what's your dad's biggest fear?
His biggest fear is having any fears. I didn't want to know anything ahead of time. I wanted to walk up to the chopper, get briefed, and do the jump. I wanted to find out in real time, along with the audience, how it was all going to go down. Hey, Will, I'm TJ, your stunt coordinator. Let me run you through the basics. You're going to be jumping on a 200-foot active bungee cord. We've got multiple redundant safeties, chest, two to the waist. This cord is an engineering marvel made from hundreds of individual strands of rubber coated to reduce friction and wear. More strands, more safety. Your body weight is about 200 pounds, right?
Well, minus the 18 pounds of fluid and other matter I'm currently shedding due to the crippling terror I'm experiencing, yes.
You're going to put 3 Gs into this cord, which when you multiply it by your weight, means you're going to put about 600 pounds of force on it. At the maximum point of stretch, you will have fallen 550 feet. Then you'll bounce several times before ending up hanging about 325 feet below the chopper. Then we'll bring you back to the crash pad, unhook you, everybody sings happy birthday, and we head home. Any questions?
Wait, hold on a second. I just had a terrible thought, I said. After this bungee cord stretches, isn't it going to throw me back up into the rotors of the helicopter?
I hope not, TJ said, chuckling. Just kidding. That's impossible. As you accelerate under the force of gravity, you gain kinetic energy. The bungee cord stretches, absorbing that energy, but only some of it. The rest is lost as heat due to friction and air resistance. This means the rebound can never be as high as the initial fall.
All right. Yeah, cool. I figured it was totally safe.
Well, there are fundamentals to bungee jumping, but this is heli bungee jumping. So there are subtle peculiarities that make it potentially a little bit more dangerous. For a start, instead of a stable position, the chopper is moving. The weather conditions have to be just right, and we can't be too close to any walls or ledges. But you are the X factor I'm most concerned about. This bungee cord weighs over 200 pounds. When we get up in the air, there will be 3 guys holding the weight to keep it off you. But when they let it go, there's going to be about 800 pounds of pull. So you are going out of this chopper whether you like it or not. The only way you can get hurt is if when they let that cord go, you don't get away from this bird. I'm going to count down from 5, and when I get to 1, you must jump. If that cord snatches you, it's all bad.
Okay, I'm not jumping, but I'm probably going to get sued. I wonder how much the judgment will be. The average movie costs probably about $40 million, so there's no way YouTube is paying more than 2 or 3 to put this event on. Plus, what, $1 million in damages? So when I walk away right now, it's probably a $4 million decision. I can live with that.
But by then, TJ was attaching the bungee cord to my chest. Wait a second, it's not going to be attached to my back or my legs? Every bungee I'd ever seen was attached to people's legs.
We're about the same age, TJ said. Do you remember the Nesty Plunge commercial where the people would jump backwards, arms out into a swimming pool?
Yeah, I remember that one from when I was little, I said. When I get to 1, I need you to give me your best Nesty Plunge.
What? I have to jump backward?
I'm harnessed up. Double and triple checks have been completed. The whir of the chopper blades slowly increases. I move to take my seat in the helicopter. TJ stops me.
Because of the weight of the bungee cord, I'm going to keep you on the outside, on the ski, TJ says.
So I'm going to be standing on the outside when it takes off? I say, catching myself, realizing I'm on camera and I'm an international action hero.
Yeah, just get your feet firmly planted on the ski. You grab these 2 handles, hold on to them, and I've got you on a tether, TJ says,
as if that was supposed to make me feel better about being on the outside of a helicopter while it takes off and then flies over to Grand Canyon. My next and perhaps most startling surprise came as the chopper began to lift off. There is something wildly disconcerting about hanging onto the outside of a helicopter as it takes off. We're 8 feet off the ground as the chopper gently banks to the right. I look down to make sure my feet are firmly planted on the ski when suddenly the ground disappears and the 1,800-foot gorge reveals itself. My knees buckle under me. I tighten my grip on the steel handles bolted to the helicopter floor. "Meant to tell you not to look down," TJ shouted with a smile. I thought, what the hell else has he forgotten to tell me? There's a red light just to my left. A cacophony of military gibberish squawks over the multiple open radios. Everybody is shouting over the thunder of the chopper blades and the percussive timpani that is my heart. I can make out a word here and there. Altitude, copy, over, wind, check, storm. Storm? It would be terrible to nail the jump and then get struck by lightning. And then, green light. The red light in the chopper, which had been the Hoover Dam holding back the flood of this collective insanity, gives way and turns green. TJ, 6 inches from my face to be certain that there are no miscommunications, gives me the universal go sign, thumbs up. And then he shouts, "We are go! Do you copy? We are go!" I give him one nod in the affirmative, and TJ begins the countdown. 5! TJ commands aggressively, showing 5 fingers. It really is true that your whole life flashes before your eyes when you think you're going to die. What if I leap to my death in front of my children? This would be a whack-ass way to go out, and the worst birthday ever. It would be the biggest YouTube special in history, so there's that. I probably should have thought about all of this before now. I wonder what my kids would say at my funeral. 4! Me and Jada just started playing golf together. She loves it. She gets dressed for a round before the sun even comes up. All of these years, and we found something new we love doing together. We're supposed to be playing tomorrow. I enjoy playing with her more than anybody. She is the best friend I have ever had. 3! Why is TJ counting so fast? 2! Look, I'm either going to die or I'm not. If God wants me today, ain't nothing I can do about it anyway. If I die, I'm not even going to know. So, the real question is, how do I want to live? Will. 1!
Feeling like Will. Feeling like Will. Feeling like Will. Making a flip. My life is a flip. My life is a flip.
You feeling like me? I feel like a prince that turned to a king. Found me a queen. Started a family and got me a team. On top of my dreams. Joiner, I know you inspired by me, like I was inspired by Nelson Mandela. I give him a rose for every endeavor. A shout out to Julius Irving, one of the legends I worship. Muhammad Ali put the work in, he was the champ, the greatest, he earned it. I love that you think that I'm perfect, but I had plenty of mistakes and burdens. My grandmama thought I was worth it, she always guided me when I was searching. I wouldn't be me if it wasn't for her.
If it wasn't for her,
I wouldn't be Willie. I couldn't be me if there wasn't no Eddie. I wouldn't be Will if I wasn't for Philly. Ain't nothing much that you really can tell me. Willie been cold since Benny and Jerry. Must have forgot that I really get busy. They done forgot who invented Get Jiggy. Hey,
they must have forgot.
Back before there was streaming sales, way before all the iTunes and the fans had to get CD still. Hey. 60 million records sold, I was on fire. I ain't even need a grill. Did it all with no cuss words. I ain't had to curse just to keep it real. Whoa. Me and Jazz in the late 80s, writing rhymes, making tapes daily. Fresh Prince make the babes crazy. Rest in peace to James Avery. Even when the streets call me corny, I still ain't never let the hate break me. I just wanted the respect first. I still ain't never letting fame change me. New me, but I'm old school.
Old school.
Big Willie on the Pro Tools. Still fresh and I'm so smooth.
I still got on my old shoes. I give Jada 1,000 kisses, ain't nothing changed since '02. Martin Lawrence get a rose too. He a legend and a go-to. Man, I love how you break the rules. Pushing limits and you make it cool. Joining Lucas wasn't made to lose. You a legend in the making too. What a beauty, my life's a movie. I swear I'm only on take two. All my kids turned out great, and I know your son gonna be great too.
Brick by brick, building a wall that no one could break. Flip by flip, glad I could help so you could be straight. And life's a trip, but who could relate? The legends are gone, but it ain't too late to give them a rose and carry the grace, cause not every hero is wearing a cape.
Feeling like Will, feeling like Will, feeling like Will, feeling like Will, making a flip. My life is a flip, and I love it to flip.
This is Will Smith. We hope you enjoyed this unabridged production of Will. This program was directed by Sean Runnett. Producers Dan Musselman and Sean Runnett. Executive producer Jana Babatunde Bay. Music supervisor Omar Rambert. Edited by JSR Post LLC. Text copyright 2021 by Trayball Content LLC. Production copyright 2021. Penguin Random House LLC. All rights reserved, y'all. Don't be trying to steal my stuff.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.